This episode is brought to you by Canby Foursquare Church. Since 1978, it's been a place to grow, connect, and serve. Of course, during this time, no in-person gatherings are allowed, but that doesn't mean that church is canceled. You can find their live stream on Sundays at 9 a.m. on their website, canbyfoursquare.com, or on their Facebook page. Services and other encouragement is available on their Facebook page anytime. Just search for Canby Foursquare Church.
This episode is also brought to you by Chris Salee, your local health markets insurance agency. Creative solutions for your health, Medicare, and life insurance needs. Personalized advice at 503-678-5768. Welcome to the Canby Now podcast,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
If it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey, friends. It's the Canby Now podcast. I'm James Walton. Let's read the news. Canby School District voters have passed a proposed 20-year, $75 million bond issue aimed at improving school facilities and addressing deferred maintenance projects, according to the early and unofficial results of the May 19th primary election from Clackamas County. Despite a promotion effort that was more muted than originally planned due to the suddenly uncertain economic realities facing many Canby School District voters in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, the measure passed comfortably with almost 60% in favor. In a statement Tuesday night, District Board of Directors member Sarah Magenheimer said the results show voters continue to trust and invest in our students and our schools. We appreciate the trust of the citizens of Canby, she said. They continue to invest in our schools, our students, and our facilities. It is an honor that we will repay by improving our facilities so we can best serve all students in safe and secure schools. About a third of the funding has been allocated for high-priority facility upgrades and safety improvements at the district's 9 schools, while another $22 million will go toward replacing the existing 200 wing, those are the science classrooms and lab spaces at Canby High School, including design, demolition, and new construction. For a complete list of everything involved in the bond, visit our website, canbynowpod.com. The bond is not expected to raise taxes. Instead, it is designed to continue the current rates that voters passed in 2004 to build Baker Prairie Middle School. In other results, conservative candidate Tootie Smith appears to have won her bid to return to the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners after a 4-year absence. In the latest returns Wednesday morning, which included ballots from 37% of eligible voters, Smith held a 5-point lead over incumbent Jim Bernard. Smith is a conservative Republican who had previously served as county commissioner from 2012 to 2016, and in the Oregon legislature, having first been elected there in 2000. Smith grew up in southern Clackamas County and still lives in Molalla on a hazelnut farm. On her campaign website, Smith pledged to voters, "You deserve the good roads, no new taxes, and better health care you've been asking for." Late Tuesday night, her campaign shared a statement claiming victory in her bid to unseat Bernard. "Thank you to the people of Clackamas County for their support and placing their trust in me," she said. "They sent a strong message tonight that they want a county government that is accountable to them." She said she knew the campaign would be an uphill battle, but that she had worked hard to educate voters about the need for new leadership at the county level, and the voters listened. She said she is looking forward to getting to work for the people of Clackamas County and standing up for local communities. With about 31,000 ballots still to be tallied, Bernard could close the approximately 4,500 vote gap that divides the two candidates. Shortly after the first results came out, he told the Can Be Now podcast he felt it was too early to call. But he admitted in a since-deleted post to his campaign Facebook page later that night that things weren't looking good. He said, "I apologize to my supporters that you may have to deal with Tootie and her Trumpian political philosophy of lies. You still will have a great commission, but our 4 years of successful relationship building will be destroyed." Smith is poised to lead a commission with a few familiar faces, including Martha Schrader and Paul Savas, with whom she previously served on the board, and Ken Humberstam, who unseated her during her own re-election bid in 2016. The commission's fifth member, Sonia Fisher, was initially appointed in 2017 to fill the vacancy created when Bernard became chair. Fisher was re-elected 2 years ago. Schrader won her re-election bid Tuesday night with nearly 70% of the vote, while Humberstam had a commanding lead but may not have done well enough to avoid a fall runoff. He received 50%. Challengers Mark Scholl and Brianna Sagdahl tallied 27 and 23% respectively. In the quest to replace retiring Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, the victory appears to have gone to Under-Sheriff Angela Bradenburg, who had just over half the vote in the early results. The former Clackamas County Sheriff Office Sergeant Lynn Schoenfield finished second with nearly 30%, while the current Lieutenant Brian Jensen was third at 13%. If Humberstam and Brandenburg ultimately finish with more than 50% of the vote, they'll win their races outright. If not, the top two vote-getters in each race will progress to a fall runoff. In the Democratic primary for House District 39, which includes Canby, parts of Oregon City, and the surrounding rural communities, Tessa Daniel is the likely winner of the chance to challenge Republican Christine Drazen, who has held the office since 2019 and is also the House Minority Leader. Daniel pulled in nearly 60% of the vote over newcomer Julia Hill. All three women are Canby residents. Clackamas County has taken its first major step toward reopening. The Board of Commissioners voted Tuesday morning to approve the county's reopening plan, and the county's application for Phase 1 was forwarded to the office of Governor Kate Brown later that day, where it is currently being reviewed. Counties who are approved for Phase 1 may begin the limited reopening of their businesses, restaurants, bars, personal services, churches, theaters, and health clubs under new sector-specific guidelines, physical distancing restrictions, and limited occupancy requirements. They must remain at Phase 1 for at least 3 weeks before they can apply for the second phase of reopening. The county's application for Phase 1 offers detailed explanations of how the county, its health region, and healthcare systems has either met the governor's 7 prerequisites for reopening or plans to do so. In the hearing Tuesday, commissioners were of the mind that, in the terms of healthcare preparedness and capacity, we're ready, and expressed the urgent need to begin reopening an economy ravaged by the COVID-19 shutdown. They also encouraged citizens to continue to do their part, following all the recommended public guidelines, including wearing face coverings while in places where it might be difficult to meet the physical distancing requirements. Said Clackamas County Chair Jim Bernard, "If we see a surge and have to shut down again, we could lose a lot of lives." Turning in the application is only the first step in the process, and approval is not guaranteed. Last week, Governor Brown approved 31 of the 33 counties that had applied to begin reopening on May 15th. The two she denied were Marion, one of the state's largest and most severely impacted counties, and neighboring Polk. "My job is to make hard decisions, even when they are unpopular," the governor said in a press conference. "When it comes to the health and safety of Oregonians, the buck stops here." A Baker County Circuit Court judge on Monday issued an injunction that, briefly invalidated Governor Kate Brown's coronavirus executive orders statewide. The Supreme Court later issued an emergency stay, keeping the orders in place for the time being until the High Court reviews the matter and issues its own decision. The Baker County lawsuit was on behalf of a group of Oregon churches, pastors, and other faith leaders alleging that the governor's orders infringe on their constitutional rights to worship freely. In his May 18th decision, Judge Shurtcliffe agreed. The governor has an enormous responsibility to protect the lives of the citizens of our states, balanced against the citizens' constitutional rights to freedom of religion, which includes how he or she chooses to worship, he wrote. The governor's orders are not required for public safety when plaintiffs can continue to utilize social distancing and safety protocols at larger gatherings involving worship, just as grocery stores and businesses deemed essential by the governor have been authorized to do so. The judge found that the governor's orders violated Oregon law by failing to follow the 28-day time limit contained in Oregon Revised Statutes 433, which give her the authority to declare a state of emergency for public health situations. Governor Brown invoked a different statute when she declared a statewide disaster, ORS 401, which has no time limit for emergency declarations. However, she did use provisions of ORS 433 in some of her executive orders. Judge Shurtcliffe found that when she used these provisions, it effectively triggered the entire statute, including the time limit. Because the governor implemented statutory provisions, she is bound by them, the judge wrote. Thus, once the maximum 28-day time provisions of ORS 433.441 Section 5 expired, the governor's executive order and all the other orders were rendered null and void. In a statement Monday, Governor Brown pleaded for Oregonians to continue to follow the guidelines outlined in her executive orders. The science behind these executive orders hasn't changed one bit, she said. Ongoing physical distancing, staying home as much as possible, and wearing face coverings will save lives across Oregon. The governor said that only physical distancing, wearing face coverings, staying home as much as possible, and gradually reopening communities will keep Oregonians safe and save lives from the threat of the novel coronavirus. We all look forward to visiting our loved ones in nursing homes, sending our children to school, and going to the grocery store without fear of spreading this disease, she said. But the simple fact remains, COVID-19 is here in Oregon, and lives are at stake. A Canby law firm filed a similar lawsuit against the governor in federal district court last week on behalf of business owners claiming the governor's orders violated their rights and have done, quote, extraordinary harm to their businesses. An employee at the Safeway grocery store in Malala has tested positive for COVID-19, the Can Be Now podcast has confirmed. The employee has not worked at the Malala store since May 6th, according to Jill McGinnis, the communications director for the Oregon-Washington region of Albertsons Companies, which owns Safeway. The store has been through multiple cycles of deep cleaning, sanitizing, and disinfecting since that day, she said. Associates were informed of the positive test result on the same day that it was communicated to the company, she said. Due to HIPAA concerns, only employees who had been in close contact with the individual were made aware of their identity. She said store associates have been reminded to wash their hands, disinfect check stands every hour, and practice social distancing. They are also being directed to stay home and call their healthcare provider right away if they develop a fever and symptoms of respiratory illness, including a cough or shortness of breath. Our thoughts are with the associate who tested positive, and we hope for a full recovery, McGinnis said in an email. During a visit to the store on West Main Street in Malala Monday afternoon, all visible safety guidelines appeared to be being observed. Occupancy was limited to 395, and there was a single point of entry. All employees were wearing face coverings in accordance with the latest requirements from the governor's office, as were many patrons. Malala has seen 32 confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus as of last Tuesday, according to the latest report from the Oregon Health Authority, three more than neighboring Canby, despite having a smaller population. An unfair summer might be getting a little brighter. The Clackamas County Fairgrounds and Events Center is exploring the possibility of showing drive-in movies during a year where most of its large public events, including the county fair and rodeo, have had to be canceled out of concern for the coronavirus pandemic. The process was still in the very early stages, according to marketing and events coordinator Tyler Neiser. "We're going to get rolling on it," he told the Camping Out podcast. "Right now, we're just seeing if it's feasible and if it meets the executive order. But we're putting the numbers together and trying to make it work. We'd love to bring this to the community because we know people are wanting to get out." Neiser provided the first update on the project to the Clackamas County Fair Board last week, and he said they were in complete support. "Oh, the Fair Board is behind it," he said. "If we can meet all the requirements, then they're totally for it. They're excited that we might actually be able to use the fairgrounds in this time." Though he's never been given the go-ahead before, Neiser said this is not the first time the idea of drive-in movies at the fairgrounds has come up. "Honestly, it's always been something we've wanted to do here. Obviously, this is the perfect opportunity for it, but it's always been in the back of my mind. And maybe in the future, it's something we could still use to bring something fun to the community during a weekend that we don't have something else happening at the fairgrounds." Of course, there is a reason only a handful of drive-in movie theaters still exist in the entire state. There are the matters of equipment, staffing, bathrooms, concession, movie licensing rights, and the ever-present social distancing guidelines that must all be taken into account. Fairground staff have not settled on a location for where the temporary or possibly permanent drive-in theater would go, and he confirmed they are also exploring the possibility of arranging drive-in concerts. "There's a lot that we have to take into this consideration," Neiser admitted. "But we're hopeful. We're working really hard, and we really want to make this happen for the people, if we can."
And it's time for my favorite part of our show, Police Beat, for the week of March 31st through April 6th. On March 31st at 12:59 a.m., a speeding vehicle drifting into oncoming lane was stopped. The suspended driver was arrested on an outstanding warrant, and four passengers suspected of unlawful entry into motor vehicles earlier that night were detained. Multiple reports of unknown persons unlawfully entering unlocked vehicles overnight on Northeast 10th Avenue, and multiple reports of thefts from unlocked vehicles overnight on North Locust and Northeast 4th Avenue. At 10:03 p.m., officers responded to a report of a theft in progress. The suspect and a possible accomplice were located driving a vehicle previously reported stolen and were arrested. Most of the stolen items were recovered. On April 1st, April Fools, but this actually happened. On April 1st at 12:30 p.m., response to a suspicious circumstance in the parking lot of a store. Driver of a vehicle previously reported stolen was arrested for unauthorized use of a vehicle, also known as stealing a vehicle. And to add some frosting on top of this delicious little crime cake, he was in possession of methamphetamine and multiple outstanding Clackamas County and Molalla Municipal Court warrants. The suspect was also trespassed from the location. On April 2nd at 12:25 a.m., a speeding, uninsured vehicle was impounded. The vehicle was uninsured, but the driver sure was sure about going too fast. That was a bad joke. We're going to skip over that. And the suspended driver was cited. They were seen by the police. On April 3rd at 10:30 p.m., responding to a possible road rage incident, officers located and stopped a vehicle failing to maintain its lane of travel. If you're too angry to drive, that doesn't mean that you're allowed to just go wherever you want. You still have to stay in your lane, man. The driver was arrested for DUI, reckless driving, and violation of a release agreement. The driver was also cited for not having a license, open container, and a minor in possession of alcohol and marijuana. This person just really loaded it up. The only thing they were missing was the meth or heroin. But you know what? They don't all have it. Not always. On April 5th at 11:43 a.m., response to a report of vandalism to a parked vehicle overnight. See, those parked vehicles, they're just not safe here in Canby. Everyone hates them, but they don't do anything. They literally just sit there. And there's some more evidence of it. At 9:30 p.m., report of a window of a vehicle being smashed while parked in the store parking lot. Didn't do anything. Didn't call your name. Didn't say anything about your mom. But you still had to violate it. On April 6th at 11:32 a.m., report of an unexpected package being delivered to a residence, followed by an unknown person removing that package from the home. So, showed up. Nobody knew what it was. Person showed up and took it. Nobody knew what it was. It's not really a crime as much as just weird. And that's how that week ended. Awesome. Glad to be back.
Canby, Direct Link is here for you. In these troubling times, the last thing anyone should have to worry about is how to stay connected to their loved ones, work, education, and news. The expert staff at DirectLink are all based right here in Canby and are committed to keeping those critical internet, video, and voice connections on and strong for their members. They have signed the Keep Americans Connected pledge from the FCC, which means they have promised to keep students online to continue their studies, local businesses connected to their customers and employees, and all their members virtually in touch with what matters most to them, no matter how far away they may be. So if you have DirectLink as a provider, go ahead and reach out to your loved ones on a traditional telephone, watch a child's home recital over an internet video chat, download your favorite local podcast, do we even have to ask what it is, or enjoy a favorite movie at home, because DirectLink will keep our friends, neighbors, and local businesses connected, no matter what. We're all in this together.
Hey friends, my favorite part of the episode, as always, is letting you know about the most wonderful people in the world, the Canby Now supporters on Patreon. These are the Canby Now Plus members. This week, we're going to give a special shout out to Sarah Hepler. Sarah, if you're listening, thank you for being a faithful monthly supporter of the Canby Now podcast, enabling us to deliver local, accurate, and timely journalism in an era in which it is needed the most. So thank you, Sarah, for allowing us to do something that we love a great deal, informing the Canby area of what's going on. If you would like to be one of the coolest people in the world, like Sarah, find out how you can be a supporter of ours on Patreon. You can visit us at canbynowpod.com/plus to sign up. Thank you so much, Sarah. Appreciate you a great deal.
Canby has seen 29 cases of the novel coronavirus as of this week, according to the latest numbers from the Oregon Health Authority. And one of those is local resident Katarina Wirt, who joins us on the line now. Hi, Katarina.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Why don't you start by telling us just a little bit about your experience with COVID-19?
So my experience with it is not quite, it was bad, but it wasn't quite so negative like everybody else is making it out to be.
Sure.
I believe I got exposed sometime around April 19th-ish. That's kind of what we're thinking. And probably within 2 to 3 days after exposure, I got a really bad sore throat, where it hurt so bad I had to use that numbing spray to the back of my throat. Uh-huh. And I thought maybe I had gotten strep or tonsillitis, but it just looked red and didn't look anything else. So then,
did you have
that
other symptoms?
Continued. The other symptoms were just like, I felt really tired, just drained.
Yeah.
But not much else for the first few days. Then about a week in, I noticed I had zero sense of smell. Like, I couldn't smell nothing. I still had, like, some taste, but then everything started to taste like soap. I don't know if you've ever tasted soap before, but it tasted like if I would drink my coffee, it tasted like somebody had put Dawn dish soap in it.
That's so gross. Yeah, I have I had a grandmother who would make me lick the soap if I said a swear word, so I have tasted soap.
Yeah. It's really gross.
Yeah.
And then once that happened, I was reading up about it, and I was like, God, I wonder if I have COVID. So then I just joked about it, and, you know, because I kind of take life with a grain of salt. I've had a lot of bad things happen in my life, but I figure if you don't have a positive attitude about it, of course, it's going to be all doom and gloom all the time.
Well, that's wonderful.
So I just laughed about it, and I was like, yeah, I probably do have COVID. And I joked around with it.
Just my luck, right?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And honestly, when I say that, my luck is, like, I have compromised immune system.
Right. That was the concerning thing about your case, like you said, even though the
symptoms
weren't. Yes,
and so I figured... Yeah, and I figured if anybody would get it, it would most likely be me and the family.
Yeah.
And so when I was 10, I had Reye syndrome, and that has left me with multiple issues for the rest of my life, which has made me immunocompromised. So fast forward, at this point, I'm just not feeling just normal. I'm just still so drained. I'm so tired. I'm still trying to do a little bit of work, but mostly just chilling at home. I was making face masks, and I just wasn't doing a whole lot more of anything else. And then at this point, my foot is hurting too. So
yeah,
I went and saw my doctor a couple of times for that. And I'm not having no dry cough, none of that, no fevers. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, I just kind of around the 29th, I believe it was, around then. Hold on, I'll look at the date.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometime around the 28th or the 29th, I just kind of started taking a turn for worse.
Yeah.
So I went in and I got tested on the 30th of April. Well, May 1st,
I know because I've researched and I've actually seen it done, but can you, for maybe folks who don't know or don't realize, can you describe the test and maybe what that experience was like for you?
It was really not that bad.
Really?
I mean, people say, so because I'd had all these symptoms and I had been emailing my doctor, because I'd emailed my doctor back and forth a few times.
Yeah.
And then I had called the nurse and I was like, hey, I now have no sense of smell. I have no, like, everything tastes like soap. I said, I think I should probably get tested just to be on the safe side.
Right.
And they asked me about the low-grade fever. I was like, nope, coughing, nope. And I was having some coughing here and there, but nothing like, nothing what you would expect.
Right.
So I got tested. So the test, they went ahead and scheduled. It was scheduled within like 15 minutes. Hmm. And I drove up and waited in the car, and they just swabbed my nose. And they don't stick that in very far. If they do, that's weird, but that was not my experience.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard some people saying that, like, you know, they got a little brain matter with my swab, I think, but...
No, I mean, it did cause me to sneeze, but no, that was not my experience. Okay. I mean, they just put it up your nose.
Yeah. It's a,
but anyway, that was it.
Yeah.
And I went home and pretty much laid around the whole rest of the day. But then Friday morning, 7 a.m., the county calls me, county health department, and they told me that I had tested positive.
Okay.
So, and then after that is when I started to feel shitty, or excuse my language, I just started feeling worse.
That's okay.
And I think maybe it was like, because now I'm like, oh God, I do have it.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't feel so good.
Psychosomatic.
Yeah. Yep. No panic here, because I'm just like, okay, well, I'll deal with it. But by this point, I was like starting to get a lot of body aches. Very bad body aches. It's like where you worked out really hard.
Yeah.
And then the next day you're so stiff that it even hurts to walk upstairs because you're so sore.
Yeah.
And at this point, my doctor had prescribed me my asthma inhaler, some cough medicine, because I was getting the cough more. I think they got even some anti-nausea medication because it made me very nauseous. That was something that I noticed very differently with this virus, or being sick this time, is the nausea. It was really bad.
Yeah.
And I just pretty much stayed in bed from like that May 2nd through the 3rd, and then on Monday morning, I woke up and I literally felt like I couldn't breathe. Like, I felt like I would try to do the deep diaphragm breathing and I just couldn't. It was so painful. And I just went to the ER. I called in ahead of time, told them, hey, I'm pretty sure I have pneumonia now. I tested positive for COVID and I'm coming in. And I did. They took me in to like a back door and into the isolated rooms, and that was it. And they did x-rays and saw that I had bilateral pneumonia.
Oh my gosh, Kat.
And it was a
that's scary.
Yeah, and I've had pneumonia, so I was very familiar with it. And I'm also, you know, and I have like seasonal asthma, so it's like, okay, it was different from that.
Means it's in both lungs.
Yeah, both lungs. And it was a different type of a pneumonia. So it was like, I think they have a different name for it. It's almost like a broken glass is what it looks like. And it was deeper, the lower to the bottom part of the lungs. And they just put me on medication and, on antibiotics and, they gave me the option of you can either go to the Providence Hospital in Portland where they have the COVID floor and stay there at the hospital, or you can go home with a virtual nurse and just it'll pass because we caught it early enough. And that was my option, and I chose to go home because I'd rather be sick in my own bed.
Sure.
And went home and had virtual nurse check-ins every few hours. And I just slept a lot.
Yeah.
That, and once the pneumonia kicked in and all of that started to get worse, then that's when I started having the fevers and the chills, and I just felt really awful.
Yeah.
Just probably the... besides Reye syndrome, it was probably one of the few times that I was probably the most sick in my life.
And it's hard to say kind of how much of the symptoms were attributed to COVID-19 and how much were the pneumonia.
Yeah. And the thing is the pneumonia, and I do believe that it is very deadly for people that are immunocompromised, and I think they should be careful. And it can be like if you're elderly, you're more fragile, it can kill you. But because I was very well aware of my body, and because I was like, okay, this isn't normal, and I've had an experience with pneumonia before, because it was early intervention,
yeah,
and early treatment is what really is the key to all of it, I think, for like getting better from it.
Yeah.
But it was crazy how quick the pneumonia set in. I went from feeling to feeling horrible. And then to like within 12 hours, I just went like, oh my God, I feel so god awful. This is horrid.
Oh my gosh. Were those the technical medical terms that the doctors asked? Do you feel or
Yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel? I'm like, I feel like a 9.
Yeah. About how long did you struggle with these symptoms?
So once I started taking the antibiotics, so they started me on the 4th for the antibiotics. By Wednesday, the 6th or 7th, I felt fine. I felt good.
Good. Wow, so about a week you were dealing with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And I, by the time, the 9th rolled around, I felt great.
Yeah.
And then by the 10th of May, I was like, okay, well, I feel really good. And then all of last week, I was still under quarantine, so we just stayed home all week.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about that. When the county reached out to you, did they do kind of the contact tracing type stuff that we hear about? Did they ask you who you've been in, you know, close contact with?
I did. They did. So this is where I was perplexed. So they asked me who I was all around. My husband took 2 weeks off of work because, you know, because he was exposed to me and quarantined with me. Plus, I needed him home. Right. But I gave the county where he worked, people he was around, because he was exposed. We have a caregiver for my son, my husband, my niece. There was also other friends that I was around. I had a friend that came over and gave me a haircut. And crazy enough, they also had COVID at their house. That was positive. And honestly, the county refused to test them. They just simply said, we're not testing anybody that's not exhibiting any symptoms.
Yeah.
And it was really strange.
If even in some cases that they have symptoms, but it's not severe and there was known contact with a confirmed case, they'll just, you know, tell you, well, you just assume that you do have COVID.
Yeah. And no, like I know people that were around other people and tested and they had negative results. I mean,
yeah.
But I found it really strange that they just simply wouldn't test all these other people.
Yeah.
And they gave names, and we wanted them to get tested because
sure.
we wanted to know who else might be positive, because my husband never got tested and my sons never got tested, and it's like, okay, why not? And I went back and forth on this numerous times, and I repeatedly asked, I text the county, because I had a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner assigned to me, and I text her, and they just simply said no, they weren't going to do it. And I found that baffling, and I just couldn't understand why. I'm like, you would think that they would want to have more accurate numbers. And it bothered me. It actually still bothers me, because now I'm like, okay, you guys are shutting everything down and not allowing all these things to be open, but yet you're not doing the testing. You're refusing to do the testing. That's what I couldn't seem to wrap my mind around.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that's a very valid question, and I certainly can't answer it, but I can understand where you're coming from there when you have folks that are, you know, really desperate to get these tests done, and we know that there is the capacity now. The county filed their application for reopening with the Oregon Health Authority and the governor's office this week, and actually our health region has about twice the testing capacity of even what's required. So we know the capacity is there. I suppose I speak for the protocols that are going into the testing, but the frustration is appreciated, at least on my end. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is I've asked to be retested, and they flat out refused to do it. I've asked for antibody testing, and same. They refused to do it. And I was like baffled, because I'm like, okay, I don't understand, why not?
Yeah, sure.
You would think that they would want to gather as much data as possible.
Yeah.
But they just said we're just not doing it right now.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that'll change as we walk through this process. I mean, this is the first COVID-19 pandemic that we've all been through, so. Learning as we go. Katarina, you are very open about your experience, obviously. We initially kind of heard about you and seeing a comment that you had posted on one of our articles on Facebook. I was curious about that. You've also kind of mentioned in this interview and in discussions you and I have had offline that it seems to be kind of a desire of you to fight against some of that fear that people might have that, yeah, obviously, as you said, it can be deadly, but most, in fact, the very great majority of people who contract this virus do survive without really any lasting effects that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is
that
why
is correct.
You are so open about your experience?
I am. That is actually the main reason why, because once I got sick and really bad and got the diagnosis of the bilateral pneumonia, I had people messaging me asking me what color my toes were, what else, what other symptoms I had going on, all these other like crazy questions, and there some people have like congratulating me for surviving COVID, and I'm like, this is like a, it felt like a flu.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
Like
a bad flu, you said, but yeah, the flu.
A bad flu.
Yeah.
But that was it. And it's like, oh, okay. And I've had pneumonia before. Nobody's congratulated me for surviving that. And so it just was the most random questions, like, or things that people, and when I went into the ER, because at this point, like, I'm like struggling to breathe and I just felt horrible, and they're like, oh, we need to give you some Ativan, some anti-anxiety medication. I'm like, I'm not anxious. I wasn't anxious at all. I just felt like, I know I have pneumonia and let's just deal with that. But it did help, because it helped relax my body and I was able to breathe a little bit better. But they're like, well, we understand that you feel very anxious at this time. And I'm like, I'm not anxious.
Yeah.
And I kept telling that to myself. I'm not anxious. Stop making me think I'm anxious.
Well, they're trying to help, I guess.
Yeah. No, they were sweet. They were very sweet at the hospital. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But that's the main, and on, and I personally, I feel like it was warranted to do the shutdown to begin with, but now I feel that if you're gonna, I mean, it depends on your immune system, and you may get it and you may not. And we're pretty sure my husband and my sons had it. They just had very mild symptoms. Like, my husband just had a fever for a couple of days, and that was it. Same with my son. And they all lost sense of smell.
Yeah.
But that was it. Like, I mean, I think we need, like, a herd immunity. It's going to be the best way to combat it.
Would you tell people, you know, be cautious, but afraid, like don't be afraid, you know?
No, don't be afraid at all. It's a flu. If you're not afraid of getting just pneumonia, even in general, or having
seasonal flu,
seasonal flu. I actually think the seasonal flu is far more deadly than COVID flu was. It's the same. It felt the same to me. So I don't know what else I can answer.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate, obviously, you know, pretty much everything you just told us is private information that you could have legally told us to just buzz off and mind your own business. So I'm very appreciative of you for sharing your experience, because there are a lot of people that are afraid. There are, and a lot of that comes from a lack of knowledge, right?
This is
a novel coronavirus, as we say. It's something humanity hasn't experienced before. And people that have actually gone through it, you are the ones on kind of those front lines, along with our frontline healthcare workers, who are able to tell us exactly what, you know, the threat is and exactly what it looks like. And in the absence of that, we just have our own imaginations that can take us to weird places. So I really appreciate you and your time, Katerina. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know, and the sad thing is, like, and kind of in a funny way, is when you tell people, oh, I've had coronavirus, they like kind of cringe and back away from me.
Right.
And I'm just like, I'm not.
Stigma. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it is. It's a very weird stigma. And I just tell people, I'm just like, I'm going to wear it proud. It's a proud badge. I've had COVID. Oh, well.
Yeah.
You know, and it kind of reminded me of like how people would react to when there was the AIDS pandemic.
Right.
It's where like people were like, oh my God, if you breathe around me, I'm going to get AIDS from you. In this case, you could get COVID if somebody breathes around you, but
right. It's
a bad flu and you will get over it. Most people do. I actually now know several people that tested positive in the Canby area that are part of that 29. And they've all made recoveries and they're all fine, back to work and everything. So, and they're, some of them are my friends that are people that I was around. So,
yeah. Well, have you guys talked about getting t-shirts yet?
We thought about it.
I survived COVID.
Especially those. Yeah, especially the people that congratulate us for surviving.
Right.
Like,
right.
Well, maybe we should get a t-shirt. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Katerina. We are glad that you survived. We're glad that you're feeling better. And again, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Joining us once again on the Canby Now podcast is Derek Hill of Advantage Mortgage. He joins us on the line, of course. How are things in the industry right now with all the crazy stuff going on?
You know, it's a little crazy, but not too crazy. I mean, we definitely have seen some things tighten up. Obviously, with any kind of uncertainty, banks tend to tighten their guidelines. So the great thing about being a broker is that even though some of our lenders are tightening up, we have others that aren't. We have a lot of lenders that are just status quo. They're like, hey, we still have all the same channels. We still have all the same credit score requirements. You know, interest rates may be a little bit higher because of the level of risk, but they're still funding loans. So actually March was one of the biggest months of our company's funding. So
wow.
You know, we're still funding loans. There's still people out there buying. There's still people out there selling. We have to make sure that we're not, you know, spreading the virus and whatnot, but yeah, everything's still moving along.
Cool. So how can people get in touch with you right now?
The easiest way is just call the office, 503-266-5800, or send us an email, derek@findtheadvantage.com. But just call the office and we'd be happy to help.
Awesome. Thanks, Derek. Hang in there.
All right, you as well. Derek Hill, NMLS 50183, Equal Housing Opportunity.
Gamby Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop, open daily. Though the store is currently closed for walk-in sales, they offer a variety of online shopping experiences along with free delivery in Canby. You can connect with them through email at retrorevivaloc@gmail.com. Today, a look at one aspect of Canby's history that's sure to make a splash. Our town has the good fortune of being nestled on the banks of not one, but two rivers, the Willamette and the Mallala. So, water for drinking, bathing, washing, irrigation, and of course, epic water balloon fights has not been the challenge in Canby that it has often been for some of our neighbors to the east and south. Nevertheless, it is a colorful history and one that, not surprisingly, intertwines with that of an old friend, Mr. Canby himself, M.J. Lee, the dynamic grandson of Canby pioneer and founder Philander Lee, who was also instrumental in the city's early forays into electricity, but he played an even larger role in establishing the first water system here. In the earliest part of the 20th century, M.J. Lee was determined to accomplish something that many men older and seemingly wiser than he said could not be done: bring irrigation to the Canby Prairie. It was said that Canby's sandy soil was unsuitable for carrying water in open ditches, according to an early newspaper article of the day. But Lee was never one to let challenges get in the way of a good idea. It took him large sums of money and the entirety of his considerable energy, time, and attention for the better part of 4 years, but he did it, and in the process earned yet another nickname, as if he needed it. For the first time in the history of Canby Prairie, a July 1911 article in the Canby Tribune announced, water has been supplied for the thirsty fields, lawns, and orchards through the medium of irrigation, and the long-sought-for goal and dream of the promoter and father of irrigation in the Willamette Valley, M.J. Lee, is fast taking form and realization. Lee started digging his ditches in Meadowbrook, down Mill Creek, and into Canby Prairie, but to expedite the process and really get things flowing, he constructed a flume leading into the Mallala, which crossed under the railroad tracks at one point. Lee, who had always believed in a bright future for the town he loved so dearly, was of the unshakable mind that irrigation was the key to unlocking the area's potential for growth and prosperity. Or, as he was fond of saying, irrigation is king. And the Tribune seems to agree. With the completion of the flume line and the wonderful increase in productiveness of our soil fully established, we expect to see the completion of the High Line Canal and an even greater increase in our productiveness shown, the newspaper said. Since the birth of this project, our little city has been on the gradual increase, not in the nature of mushroom growth, but with substantial and beautiful homes and buildings, and with the backing of a wonderfully productive county, assisted by a strong publicity campaign, we hope to place Canby on the map among her most conspicuous sisters as the hub and center of the most wonderfully attractive and alluring towns in the Willamette Valley. The father of irrigation was proud of his accomplishment, and when he started a county newspaper that same decade, he named it, what else? The Willamette Valley Irrigator, which later merged with the Canby Tribune and a wonderful little circular in neighboring Aurora that went by the name of the Aurora Borealis. Around that same time, the city's first water pumping station was established. Like the electric system, the water supply is owned by the city and has been for more than a century, which is unusual for Oregon. In the early days, drinking water was supplied from a drilled well at the northeast corner of Northwest 4th and Fir, and stored in an elevated wooden tank, which, ironically, burned to the ground in October 1919. Evidently learning a lesson similar to the one learned by the Three Little Pigs of fairy tale lore, the city employed an engineer to design a 100,000-gallon elevated steel storage tank to be built at the same location. In an election which also included a proposed measure prohibiting the running of livestock through Canby streets, it passed, voters rejected a $20,000 bond to build new waterworks for the city. However, a smaller amount of $7,151 was later overwhelmingly endorsed by property owners between Canby and Knights Bridge, and the new tank was built. The city council paid off the sum in April 1926. The distribution system for the downtown core area was constructed between 1916 and 1922 and is still in use today, even despite an unfortunate episode in January 1921 when typhoid fever germs were found in the city's water by the State Board of Health. Schools closed for the day and students were required to bring their own water, boiled for safety. Sometime later, and probably unrelated, the city had another well drilled at the same site about 700 feet deep. Among other minerals, the water contained a considerable amount of sulfur, and the well became known as Old Stinky. Around 1929, the city employed a contractor to build a concrete system of collection boxes, gallery, and pipelines on the Molalla River, from which water was pumped into the distribution system and a storage tank at a volume of 250 gallons a minute, thanks to the wonders of electricity. A second 250 gallon per minute electric pump was added later. Even more water was needed in 1944, and the city again employed a contractor to construct a concrete collection gallery approximately 18 feet in diameter and about 24 feet deep, with openings in the walls to permit water to enter from the underground aquifer. A 40-horsepower motor with an 800-gallon-per-minute pump was installed. Between 1950 and 1951, a 30-inch diameter corrugated metal pipe with perforations to admit the water was installed about 18 feet below ground and approximately 300 feet in length and connected to the gallery that had been built in 1944. This well performed very well until the mid-60s when the water source was deemed insufficient to supply the demand. By force account and with the water department's employees, a mechanical system of pressure pumping was installed and a contract was awarded to build a 500,000-gallon ground-level storage tank. This helped to meet the demands for the next 3 to 4 years, and then more water was required during the summer months. To meet this requirement during the years of 1968 to 1970, water was pumped directly from the Molalla River and ponded above the infiltration tube leading to the collection gallery and then pumped into the distribution system. In 1970, the city created the Canby Utility Board, or CUB, to operate, manage all of its facilities, services, and aspects of the Canby Municipal Water Department. And that same year, design work began on a pump station at the Molalla River that would have the capacity to pump over 3 million gallons of water per day. Subsequent expansions in 1980, 1995, and 2006 have improved the facility's capacity to now 8 million gallons of water per day, along with 20 million complaints during the summer months about how it tastes. Ha! Hello? Hello, can you hear me now? Oh. Can you hear me now? Hey, it's the history of Canby's telephone service next time on Canby Then. As always, friends, thanks for listening to the Canby Now podcast. I'm James Walton. Have a great day.
This episode is brought to you by the Wild Hair Saloon in Canby in Oregon City. The coronavirus has changed much about how the Wild Hair does business, but it has not changed the where, the why, or who they do it for. Owners Joan and Darren Monin, both lifelong Canby residents, are as committed to the community they love as they've ever been. Even as the service industry has been deeply impacted by the current public health situation, they continue to rally behind Canby, its people, and especially those most in need. We are so grateful for their continued support in this difficult time. As we've always said, the Wild Hair is a place where Canby goes to eat and have fun. That hasn't really changed. You just have to take your food and, you know, go eat it somewhere else. Until the governor's stay-home orders expire, the Wild Hair's friendly staff will be there to handle your carryout orders Monday through Friday from 11:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. They continue to offer their full menu of delicious food options, and they're doing a weekly meal deal that serves a family of four for only $25. Find the latest on their Facebook page, full menu available online at thewildhairsaloon.net. Give them a holler today at 503-651-4273.
The Canby Now podcast is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. Find more of her work at olivia13.com.
The
The Camping Out podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The Camby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Camby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.